Coming up on This Week in Radio Tech, oh my goodness, if we got a show for you. It's episode number 400. It's a War Stories episode, and Chris Weigel is joining Chris Tobin and me. It's a great show coming up. Stories and great advice on TWRT.
This Week in Radio Tech is brought to you by Broadcasters General Store, with outstanding service, saving, and support, online at bgs.cc. By the new Ruby console from Lavo. See Lavo in your future at lavo.com/twrt. And by the Telos Alliance, shaping the future of audio, inspiring you to create the most exciting and engaging audio experiences imaginable. Visit telosalliance.com/opt-in.
Hey, welcome into This Week in Radio Tech. It's the show where we talk about everything from the microphone to the light bulb at the top of the tower and all the digital and analog and stuff in between. It's our 400th show. Oh, my goodness. Did you think we'd make it this long? I don't want to quit till we're at 1,000. How about that? Let's go to show number 1,000, and then I might call it quits there. But this is our 400th show, and with me for almost every single show has been my friend, my partner in the show, and a respected engineer, Chris Tobin from the New York City area. Chris, welcome in.
Well, thank you, Kirk. Yes, 400 episodes. Who would have thought? And I was just talking about our show to somebody the other day, and they said, well, do you think podcasting has any legs? Do you think it goes anywhere? I'm like, I don't know. Do you think 390 episodes is good for a show? Well, yeah, I guess so. Well, then I can tell you this. It's got some legs, because I told him some other story. He's like, oh, wait a minute. I know that podcast. Yes, that's me. So, yes, 400. I'm excited. I think it's great.
Chris, we're both out of our usual environs for this show. I think I've seen you there before at that venue. Tell me what's going on.
This is our monthly public affairs show here at WBGO. It's the Newark Today program, and it's the mayor's show. It's the Ask the Mayor, if you will. So tonight we'll have the mayor of Newark, Mayor Roz Baraka, here talking about, and this is his second term. He was just sworn in, and or he will be sworn in, I think, July 1st. Is that how it works? And it's going to be fun. So we do it live on location, both radio and on Facebook Live and our webpage. So you get to see everything. So I got two video cameras, lights, and all kinds of gadgets going on here. We're actually using vMix for the switching and distribution.
Is your setup pretty similar to what we did at NAB, what you came and did for us for the show with Frank Foti?
Yes. Yes, it is exactly. It's missing one. Yeah, one camera. I had three cameras for that one. But yeah.
Yeah. Cool.
It worked out.
I've directed TV before. I'm telling you, directing with two cameras is a lot tougher than with three, because it's one or the other, and that's it.
Oh, yes. Yeah, you got to come up with the right angle positions and know how to use them and say, okay, this camera's going to do multiple shots, multiple compositions. And because we have a host, so I have to make sure there's always a shot on the host. And then the other camera's being used to set up the other shots, and it's fun. The best part is when the host forgets, he's got to sort of pause when he's introducing the next person so I can swing the camera around. So it's a challenge. It's been a challenge on a few occasions, but it's fun. But it's worked out well. And for those of you who think this is goofy that a radio station does video, think again. This is audience engagement, and I can assure you that we've had some very positive feedback from folks who've been able to watch on their phone and the archives of Facebook. It also helps too.
You actually bring up a point, and that is that radio stations are probably in a very good position to bring people video of events that maybe local TV stations don't see as worthy to cover or cover completely. And radio stations almost seems like radio stations are being where the old, maybe the cable access channels left off. I know that when I was young in this business, somehow I got snookered into doing some play-by-play, which was a disaster because I know nothing about sports, and some color for some high school football games that were, I think, recorded and played back later on a cable channel. And but, you know, we certainly knew about audio consoles. We knew about headsets and announcing. So we were kind of qualified to bring you most of that. And then we just added the cameras. And, you know, we figured that out pretty well. And this was back in the 80s we did this. And so I think radio broadcasters are well positioned to actually produce some semi-good to good TV. What do you think?
Oh, absolutely. It's without a doubt. I mean, remember, the best television, whether it's spoken word, music, whatever you want to call it, is always the best story being told. And who tells a better story than radio announcers, DJs, broadcasters?
Exactly. Exactly. So, hey, that's actually a thing for another show, because I've got some thoughts about audio and video and content of audio and content of video. That's probably worth talking about as we move forward as Radio Stations having more of that. By the way, I'm Kirk Harnack. I'm the host of the show. And, like I said, we're at show number 400. I've been here for most of them. There have been a few when Chris Tobin has taken the lead on hosting the show. So I'm in a little bit different place than usual. I'm actually in Charleston, South Carolina, and I'm here at the Cumulus Studios in Charleston. My pal and fellow SBE board member, Justin Tucker. He is a regional engineer for Cumulus. I called Justin and said, hey, I'm going to be in Charleston. Could I use a studio? And he said, absolutely. So Justin graciously let me use a studio, and he even set up some props here. They've just taken delivery of a bunch of Axia nodes because they're moving to the OpEx automation system here in Charleston. And so they got some AOIP going on. I think it's their first audio over IP in the building. So anyway, that's where I am in Charleston in this beautiful studio. Got a great view out the window here of beautiful Charleston in the summertime. It's hot, but it sure is pretty here. So that's me. That's Chris. And we have as our guest, I'm delighted to bring him back, another Chris. It's Chris Weigel from Lynchburg, Virginia. Chris, welcome into the show. How are you?
400 episodes. Are you kidding me, Kirk? That's unbelievable. Because when we first saw Twert happen, we were like, oh, it won't make it past 5 or 10. Are you kidding me? What is this thing? But hey, how many years has this spanned, these 400 episodes? Do you know?
I don't really actually know. It's about 8 years. So we've been doing this since about
8. Okay.
I started doing this just before my son was born, and he's 7, almost 8. So we've been doing this since sometime in 2009, maybe 2008,
right.
2009.
That's about right. And it was audio only.
Yeah, it was audio only. The first 20 episodes were audio only. 20 episodes. In fact, it was on another network, the twit.tv network, and Leo Laporte said, "You do 20 episodes on your own, and if you're still around, I'll put you on my network." And we did a bunch of shows on his network. And then it was time to move to a different network. We had different goals as they did. And Andrew Zarian at the GFQ network graciously said, yeah, you can come be on our network. And so we've been here ever since. I think since an episode about 100 in the 130s or 150s or so, we've been on Andrew Zarian's network. So anyway, Chris,
good question.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, earlier you raised a question about should radio stations get involved in video and this type of thing, and do radio stations have the content available for that type of thing? I love what Chris said. Radio, because of the nature of the format of being just auditory, has to spend a lot of time on that content, making sure it's what people can ingest and stay with. So why would we not want the imagery that goes along with it too? So as stations begin to put in, the webcams and the small switchers and that type of thing to stream video content, I think it's a fantastic venture to get into for sure.
And this
is setting the standard.
This is a great topic of how radio can best do video. We've had other shows devoted to this. I guess I'll summarize and wrap this little part up by saying that our friend Dan McQuillan, who's been on the show several times, has pointed out that, we shouldn't be in the business of making bad television. That's really not what we should do. What we should do is make radio shareable and searchable. And you make it shareable by having video clips, because nobody on Facebook and Twitter, you almost never see somebody sharing audio. There's got to be some video with it to draw the visual interest. So we share it by having video, and we make it searchable by doing speech to text, right? By transcribing it and having that transcription available so that search engines can pick it up. So if you want to see, where your congressman said, to use Dan's example, the word banana, you could look that up. I could look up my congressman, Cooper, and see if he said the word banana today, if he did on a broadcast station. So anyway, shareable and searchable. That's where video, at least socially, most helps, radio at this point. So anyway, welcome into our show. It's our 400th episode, and we're going to be talking about a few war stories today. Chris Weigel has some, and Chris Tobin has just done some interesting things this very week. So I can't wait to hear about that. I have a brief war story for you from, I guess, from Hawaii, from the station that I've been building there. And a couple more things. Chris Weigel is going to talk to us about an article that he's written recently talking about, sorry, not enough engineers available. We all kind of know that this time, this event, this thing has been coming. And is it creeping up on us? Is it coming at us like a freight train? Chris will have some thoughts about that. Chris Weigel will talk about that. And finally, Chris Weigel is going to have some thoughts about changing employment. When is it the right time to move to a new opportunity? And what's the right way to do that? You know, what's the right way to not burn bridges? Because it's a small industry, and you know, keep your chin up and move on to a better opportunity. So we'll be talking to Chris about that. So much to come. Oh my goodness. And we're going to start it off right after this word from my friends at Telos talking about the Infinity Intercom. Watch this.
Hi, I'm Martin Deister, Vice President of Business Development and Product Director for Telos Infinity IP Intercom System. Telos Infinity is different to any other intercom system because it's the first IP intercom system that doesn't have a matrix. Great communication within the broadcast environment is essential to TV and radio production. With Telos Infinity, you can link all your production crew, whether it's the director in the production control room, sound guy in the booth, boom operator on the floor, your anchors in the studio, presenters out in the field, weatherman, even your weatherman. Production staff listening to communications audio are hearing crystal clear sounds. It means the nuances of the people communicating with them can be heard all the time. Everything is crystal clear and accurate. The master intercom panels that we've created include multicolor LCD switches. You can use color coding to group IFBs, to group production crew members, your remotes, anybody else. Matrix-free intercom means low cost of entry, low cost of design, low cost of installation from the get-go. With Telos Infinity, you start saving money the moment you install it, and you continue to save money for the life of the product. The same benefits that broadcasters all around the world have found by using audio over IP now apply to intercom for the very first time. Never before have you been able to communicate using program quality audio simply by connecting two devices into a network switch. It truly is plug and play. Programming an intercom system has never been easier than it is with Telos Infinity. With our advanced dashboard programming utility, you can have your intercom system out of the box and up and running in record time. I'm Martin Deister, inviting you to visit telosalliance.com to learn more about Telos Infinity Broadcast Optimized Intercom System, the first matrix-free IP intercom system optimized for broadcast.
And we usually think of intercom as being something that television stations use. And of course, that's where they usually are. But you know, the very first deliveries of Infinity IP intercom systems have actually been shipped to radio stations and radio networks. So the radio people need intercom as well. In fact, that'll be a topic we're going to have. Martin Deister, fellow you just saw on that ad, is going to be talking with us in a few weeks from now. Maybe I think about 3-4 weeks from now, Martin will be on the show to talk about what's similar and what's different about putting an intercom system on audio over IP versus the kind of audio over IP that we've been getting accustomed to for the last 15 years or so. So that'll be an interesting conversation with Martin Deister coming up in about 3 or 4 weeks. So stay tuned for that. Thanks to Telos Infinity IP Intercom for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. All right, let's get into war stories. That's what we typically do on our divisible by 10 episode numbers. And this is 400, so it's divisible by 10. By 100 and by 40 and lots of other numbers too. Chris Weigel, actually, I'm going to ask Chris Weigel to start out because he's got something on the wall behind him, and it looks like a machete. Chris, is there a story behind this machete?
There is a machete right about there, and it's not the same machete for this story, but I want to go back to about 2009, maybe something like that. Liberty University, their radio network, I was instrumental in really getting that thing off. I keep hitting this mic, getting that off the ground and going from just the flagship in Lynchburg to spreading all up and down Virginia and North Carolina. And we had a couple of sites that we had built in the northern Virginia area. And one day I went on a tour of several sites, and it was one of those deals where hey, we've got a few issues we need to nail down. So I had a list of things I needed to go take care of. And it involved the Northern Virginia route. And not really knowing what I was going to get into, for some reason, I said, you know, I should probably put a 12 or a 24 foot extension ladder on top of the vehicle. And just in case, don't know what we'll see. So I take off, tool bag, everything we would need, you know, to encounter whatever we had. And we got to a site in Aquia Harbor, which is south of D.C. on 95, right along the interstate. And get off the exit, wind up our way to the top of the hill, get through the gate. And we'd been having some EBNO issues on one of the satellite receivers. In some cases, it wouldn't even come on at all. And get there and realized a tree had – the leaves had bloomed in such a way that it just totally was blocking the dish. The dish was pointed right into this branch and was way up in the tree. And I thought to myself, well, how do we get rid of this branch? So, but I had the ladder, and then I thought, wow, I really don't have anything to cut it with. And the branch was about as big around as my leg, which would have been, you know, about the size of this pop filter, 6-8 inches around. And lo and behold, in the back of the vehicle, I don't remember why I put it there, there was a machete. And so I thought, you know, we could start hacking away at that that branch and get that thing out of the way of the line of sight of that dish. And got the ladder up into the tree. That was okay. And shimmied up the ladder out onto that branch and began hacking away. Now, the machete was about the size of that machete right there. But the branch, again, was huge. And it was an oak tree, so the wood was not necessarily soft. 2 hours later, after hacking and hacking and hacking, and mind you, it was 98 degrees with unbelievable humidity. About 2 hours into that, the branch fell down. And the person on the ground gave me the thumbs up. The EBNO came back up to normal. And but it was – I've never worked that hard to get a satellite signal to be so solid. But lo and behold, it was great after that. And the branch is gone for good. But it took a while.
So I guess it never occurred to you to take a chainsaw along with you. Maybe the station didn't even own a chainsaw.
No. Didn't even think about that. And we knew it was a signal issue at the site. I was thinking maybe it was a bad cable, something like that. But got there and looked and said, oh, there's a branch. And I thought, well, that's too bad. We'll have to come back later. But no, there's a machete in the vehicle. How did that get there? But it worked. I wouldn't suggest doing that. It was terrible.
Oh, man.
It got the job done.
it's almost the hard way to take a branch down. Right. So you were on the ladder with the machete, just hacking away. Is that what it looked like?
That was it. Now the machete did have the serrated edge on the one side, and I thought, well, maybe I could saw away at it, but that was way too much. So it was just hack. And of course, Then when you get back to the studio the next day or whatever, management says, hey, we're back on in Aquia Harbor. And you explain to them what happened. And it's just, as far as they're concerned, they don't care. The branch was out of the way, and that's all that matters.
Did you consider getting rid of the whole tree?
After that, yes. Wanted to burn it down. That would have been great. But I took out enough of the branch to where now they don't have that site anymore, but it was never a problem after that because it was close to the trunk. I took the whole thing down.
Yeah.
That's wow. That's war story number one, the machete.
Well, we'll come back for another war story from you, Chris Weigel, okay. in just a few minutes. I want to check in with Chris Tobin. Chris, I was texting back and forth with Chris earlier this week, and I get this amazing picture from him. I may still have it right here. Let me see if I can bring it up on the phone. Let's see.
Podcast. I don't know if he got them or not.
You did. Okay. Well, I won't give away what you were working on, but the picture I got was this one from Chris Tobin, and you can't really see, but there is a bucket truck down there, right?
Yeah, it's this 30-foot extension bucket truck. Yes.
So you're yeah. And is that you in the bucket?
Yes, that's me in the bucket. Yeah.
You're wearing an SBE cap.
It was a very sunny day, so I thought best. Why not put my best hat forward?
All right. So what the heck were you doing in a bucket truck?
Well,
and by the way, how do I arrange for that ride? I think that'd be fun. I've never been in a bucket truck.
Oh, that's the third or fourth time I've used that truck. Well, I've actually been working on a project. It's 2 years in the making, It actually started last year. It started as a result of this podcast, Netcast. About 2 years ago, a friend of Andrew's asked him about what we're doing, and he told him about the show, and the gentleman watches the show regularly. And one of the episodes, we did Wi-Fi. Remember, I was at a thing at a sports bar, Chickies and Pete's in Philadelphia, talking about Wi-Fi and what you could do and blah, 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 and don't think of it traditionally, think of it out of the box. So he calls me up, this gentleman, and says, hey, you want to get together for some drinks and let's talk? I have a project that you might be interested in. I was like, okay, let's give it a whirl. Why not? I'm more than happy to listen. He's buying. Why not? So we off to a pub, have some pints, and he says to me, he goes, what do you think of the idea of building out a Wi-Fi network? I said, okay, where? Okay, well, that's the problem. So far, most people we talked to don't want to do it. I'm like, okay, what are we talking about? Some strange place that I have to, like, do not have anything on me that says I'm an American? What is this? It turns out it's very safe and simple. The Boy Scouts of America have several camps here in the New York City area. One of them is up in Sullivan County, upstate New York. It's called 10 Mile River. And they are looking to put Wi-Fi at the camp headquarters throughout. They have five camps. And I said, well, that should be pretty straightforward. He goes, well, there's only a small problem. I said, what's that? He goes, geography. So I said, well, show me. So he unfurls a large map on the table at the pub, and I'm looking at it going, I'm curious, that doesn't look like 3 or 4 acres of land. He goes, no, it's about 12,660 acres of campgrounds. I was like, really? Okay. Show me where you want to have these things lit up. The good thing is it wasn't for the entire campgrounds. It was just for the areas where they have the leadership, the headquarters for the scouts. The idea was to allow the parents who come up and do scouting programs to stay connected with their businesses. So it encourages them to actually come up with the kids rather than find an excuse why they couldn't. So that's the brunt of it. And also to offer the kids something to do with STEM type programs. So there's a few things involved there. So the idea was to get the several hundred megabytes from headquarters, which is 3 miles, about 3-4 miles, to the tower that's on top of a hill that oversees most of the camps for distribution. Well, the average tree height there in the camps is about 85 feet. So we had to come up with a couple of... We did some interesting things. I don't know. Did Suncast, by chance, did you get those pictures? Did they work?
He says the link that you sent him has a lot of images. It's an entire album.
Ah, idiot thing. It wasn't supposed to do that. Sorry about that. All right, look for the one with the gentleman in what looks like a bucket truck with a white antenna, the dish. It should be a blue bucket. And the ranger, he's a ranger. So I have to give credit to the rangers at this campsite. These guys are I came up with a couple of wacky ideas about mounting antennas in trees, and they were like, really? I said, how can we get up to that tree and do things? And the bucket truck is one of them. But they were able to arrange for other types of equipment to get us up into places that nobody normally goes for this kind of thing, and it worked out. So one of the pictures I'm like, there you go. Thank you. So that is a 80-foot Belka truck. That is a 5.8 gig Ubiquiti light beam. And that yellow mast that it's on is actually a fiberglass hot stick. It's the ones you see the utility companies use when they want to pull the fuses on the power lines.
Oh, yeah.
So what we're trying to do is determine in this camp, this is Aquahunga, trying to see if we can get a signal from the trout pond tower, the very large tower, that's the 100-foot tower looking out, see if we can make a signal happen. So what we do is we take that bucket truck, we go up 80 feet and above the tree, just about the tree line. Then I extend the 50-foot fiberglass pole with the little dish on top. And then down below, the other guy who I'm working with on his phone looks at the management Wi-Fi of the dish and tells me if he sees a signal, if he were linking up with the far end to make the connection. Let me just say this, 80 feet in the air in a bucket truck on a windy day with tree branches hitting you from behind is an interesting experience.
That's but why you need a machete, Chris. Take your machete.
Yes, I did it. So we made it work. We actually made it work. That particular link is about 2 miles from the tower. It's 2 miles across trees, and it actually works. So we have that link set up and up running. So we had to do the same thing at two other camps. There's another one there. See if you can find the one that has what looks like a utility pole, very thin pipe, and that round white dish on it. It's probably sitting horizontal. I think you had to flip the image. If you can find that one, this is the best part. This is the one that's no longer usable. We've 2 days ago put up a 100-foot tower now. That is the primary distribution point for everything. So it's worked out well. It was interesting because the way we went about stuff, we are shooting signals through trees and across treetops and things that should not work at all. Well, that's one of the campsite headquarters. That's actually a link. So the very top is a 5.8 link back to the main tower, one of two main towers. And the ones below are actually shooting out to the other trading posts and other parts of the campsite. The one in the middle, to the facing right, if you will, is actually shooting through trees to a log cabin across the lake to give the internet service .com services for the scouts. And the one on the and this is the main tower. That's where I was up there a couple of months back, and last year we put it up. So at the very top is a two-way radio for the Rangers, and then we have our microwave dish. The top one goes back to the headquarters building, 3.5 miles away, and that one gives us the primary distribution of internet. The one below that faces one of the other campsites, and that that picture, I didn't flip it. So that was the original primary link that connected all the campsites to the main cable distribution of the internet service coming into the site. That is a metal mast. It's about 40 feet extended with guy wires attached to it. And on top of that is the 620 millimeter light beam dish from Ubiquiti. It's quite heavy. It's not an easy thing to do. But that pole is actually strapped to a utility pole, a former utility pole. There is no use power on it now. So that was the first phase of the project. That antenna pole and everything else you just looked at, last year was the 90th anniversary of the campsite. So you could imagine a weekend of anniversary events. We clocked in at 2 terabytes of data through the network on what you just looked at. And zero complaints. And we used VLANs. We did everything to make sure the bandwidth was where it had to be. Everybody had easily 10 megabits up and down on the public Wi-Fi we put together. And then on the private management ones, they were all averaging about 200 megabits each. And nobody had a problem. We were doing everything you normally do with videos and everything else that goes on broadband Wi-Fi. So this week we put up the 100-foot tower to replace that pole that actually got snapped in half in December when the winter storms rolled through. Yes, the winter storms rolled through.
What kind of tower did you put up?
It's a Rhone 45G, 100-foot, 18-inch face. And we this one is above the tree line, and it worked very nicely.
Mm-hmm. Self-supporting or guide?
It's guide. So we poured the anchors. Anchors were poured in a week and a half ago. We did the angle of setting, the whole bit. Made sure they're where they should be. And then we tensioned up the wires on the other day. And we'll go back out this weekend and make sure everything is still in good shape. And it's doing well. And the one thing we did discover, the experiments that we did do, was interesting how Fresnel zones work. Those of you who are familiar with that, think of it like an egg-shaped oval, right, between point A and point B of an antenna signal, radio signal. We actually, it's a long shot, but I talked to a microwave engineer, a retired one, and he says it's very plausible what I did does work for the simple reason. Fresnel zones work in a way that the signal bounces inside it. If the bounce is inside in phase, the receiver at the other end gets a good signal. If it bounces out of phase, which was like multipath we know, then you have problems, and that's why the Fresnel zones have to be kept a certain width and distance. Well, I said I have half my Fresnel zone are treetops, and the other half is blue sky. What if I just skirt across the top? There's nothing to reflect out of the trees. So that means nothing reflects down. There's no out-of-phase component. It's just one side. He did it on paper. He says, that looks like it would work. Well, we did it in 3 locations, and we tested the theory. Everyone says, raise the antenna. Get up higher. The higher we went, the lower the signal went. The Ubiquiti data link, RMS, the alignment tool. So I'm like, as we lowered the antenna, the signal quality went up. And we brought it down, took a drone, put it up in the air, and followed the path. And sure enough, it was skimming the tops of the trees. As soon as we went above the treetops to try and clear the top of the tree, that's when the Fresnel zone got really out of whack. And we did it. I did it 17 times to make sure that I wasn't making a mistake, and it worked. And that antenna was strapped to a tree. It's still there. And as of yesterday, it's still passing, I think it's 65 megabits of data.
Wow. Well, I've got just a couple of questions about how you set this up. We did a whole show on this, but I may have not asked these questions or forgotten what you said. So the actual hotspots that connect to people's phones and laptops, I take it those are down inside the buildings, right?
Yes, they're the hockey pucks. You know, that's what I would call them. Yeah, the Wi-Fi access points. Yep.
Okay. And then what is the other? What is the controlling gear down in the building? Was there a router or just a switch? What's inside each building?
We use the managed switches, all managed switches. So we're doing VLANs for everything. So depending on which device plugs in where, the VLAN is everything originates from the primary headquarters building. So all the DHCP and everything goes out that way. We did recently change it out to, I think now each camp is its own island of IPs. So it makes it a little more easy to do stuff if we have to make changes. But yeah, it's all managed. Everything is managed. There's nothing just passing through. It's we have control, and using their management software, the UNMS, you're able to, and we did it last night, you can update firmware, check on far-end devices, see what's going on sitting anywhere you want within the network. And it's been very handy. We can turn things on and off. If we see traffic getting crazy at a particular AP access point, we can actually throttle it down that one. Or we can block out IP MAC addresses. There's a lot of stuff you can do. I have to credit the folks at Ubiquiti. They've come up with a very very inexpensive, very powerful product. I mean, we just started building out a mesh. The mesh network will be going up on this weekend. We're doing some that's another one we're doing that's a little wacky. Putting a sector antenna on top of a cabin and pointing it out into the woods. And we tested it. And believe it or not, without line of sight, at approximately 0.5 kilometers through the trees into several cabins along the lake, I'm actually able to get 65 megabits of data. So we're going to be making that permanent. Wow. Yeah. Yeah. I have to assume the algorithms and the radio chips they're using is not just some standard off the shelf stuff. They're definitely working the RF and the data correction.
Hmm. I'd love to hear more and see more. Occasionally I have a project that I could do like that, and I haven't got the knowledge or expertise or experience to do that. But I do hear several people talking very nicely about a lot of the Ubiquiti products. In fact, somebody that's been on the show before, Brian Jones, who works for the Telus Alliance. Brian. Yeah. Has been doing a lot of work with video cameras and remote management of these cameras for security purposes.
So, yeah. Oh, and the other thing too is for folks who, and I know people always ask this. So we do speed tests. You know, the data rate is exactly what you expect. And the best part is anywhere in the network, anywhere throughout the five camps, the highest ping response you'll get is about 12 milliseconds.
So even going through several hops.
Oh, let me tell you, there's several hops, and if you looked at a picture of this layout, you'd be like, what? Yeah, the only thing that's wired is at the main headquarters building. Everything else is wireless. It's linked, it's hopped, it's relayed. I've got dishes strapped to tree trunks and relaying between sites, and it's working very well.
I'd love to see a diagram of how this whole thing lays out. Maybe you could do that for us sometime, or do a paper for, you know, for Radio World or one of our industry trades.
Well, we're working on that. We still have phase two, which is this summer, to finish up a few things. But yeah, it's getting good.
Great war story from Chris Tobin. A great update on that too. And the bucket truck experience has got to be something. That could be, I don't know, better than a ride at an amusement park. I'd love to do that.
Even more fun. You missed it. See, I should have sent you the picture. I was on the 150-foot crane on Tuesday in a bucket, putting up those antennas on the new 100-foot tower. Oh, that was fun. Because there's a hydraulic piston you have to lock in. So otherwise the bucket goes back and forth unless you lock it in.
You didn't climb it, huh? You got a ride.
Oh, that was at the finish. I climbed the tower six times while we were putting up the sections.
Okay.
Every two sections they had to put it up. I climbed up, secured it, released lanyards. The crane pulls away. I come down.
You're stacking tower.
Oh, we were stacking tower. Yeah, I was aligning the tower. Yeah, they would lower it in place. I was pushing it together. It was full blown.
I didn't realize it was you being a tower jockey. So wow.
I was as one of the rangers says, oh, you're the tower monkey today.
This is This Week in Radio Tech, our 400th episode. We're doing some war stories. Chris Weigel is with us from Virginia, and Chris Tobin is with us as well. I'm Kirk Harnack, your host, coming to you from Charleston, South Carolina, from the Cumulus radio stations, courtesy of their regional engineer, Justin Tucker. Justin also serves with me on the SBE Board of Directors, so he's a great guy. Appreciate it very much. Our show is brought to you in part by our friends at Broadcasters General Store. And right after this announcement, we're going to, by the way, go back to Chris Weigel for a very interesting story about a dumb, inexperienced, I don't know, that's all I remember, is dumb and inexperienced. So that's dumb and inexperienced is coming up. Broadcaster General Store represents an amazing array of manufacturers, things that you need. And they've been doing this for a long time. They have got it down to a science. You call them on the phone, you go to their website, you send them an email, and they have great advice. I've taken their advice on equipment for years and years. Sometimes back in the late 80s, I would call there, talk to Candy or Carrie, and they may not have had in stock quickly what I wanted. And so they'd recommend a substitute. And I was always delighted with their advice. Never got bad advice from these folks. Well, here's some great advice. If you have an on-air show where you take phone callers, you need one of these. This is a Vox Pro. It's been around. Vox Pro has been around for a long time, and it just keeps getting better. Now, Vox Pro is now a mark of Wheatstone. Wheatstone bought the company Vox Pro, and they still have great support, and they keep developing the software with new features. But I want to show you the controller. The controller, they have them now where they're network controlled. This one is a little bit older. It has a serial control on it. Oh, I'm sorry. This one is USB control. Ta-da. Yeah, that's what this cable is. Duh. So this is a USB controlled, a controller connected to your PC. And it's all the familiar controls. If you have on-air talent that has been using Vox Pro, they don't want to go to anything else. Nothing else will do if you've been using Vox Pro. Let's take a look at a few screenshots. They keep improving the software, and it's really awesome what they do. One of the things that they do is this feature called Gap Buster. Of course, a jock would never have moments of awkward silence, but callers often do. With Vox Pro's Gap Buster, you can set thresholds for the length of a time and a pause in the conversation that lasts and replace it with your own preset timing automatically. In other words, it gets rid of gaps with a smaller amount of gap, how much you want. So the conversation still sounds natural, but it doesn't sound unnatural because of gaps. It also does background recording. With Vox Pro, you can simultaneously record and play back audio. Yeah, at the same time. So this is really handy when you're covering, for example, sports. You're recording a baseball game, but you want to excerpt a little teaser for the news of a home run being hit. Nothing to it. Grab the audio, copy it, edit it, play it, all while the full game continues to be recorded. It also has a detachable hotkeys window, on-screen hotkeys window with the ability to set up an endless number of tab pages with up to 12 rows per tab, 5 hotkeys per row. You get the idea. It's really powerful. Drag and drop your edited bits, music, and sound effects right onto these hotkeys, and you can even play multiple hotkeys at the same time. Or switch on exclusive hotkey playback mode to stop any currently playing hotkey when a new one is triggered. Either way, they also have this amazing feature called Clip Cleaner. The Vox Pro 7 Clip Cleaner toolset includes spectral display, parametric EQ, de-esser, compressor, expander, limiter, and noise gate for processing channels independently or jointly to clean and enhance the quality of noisy phone calls. But of course, it can be used for other purposes too, like special effects. Clip Cleaner is organized into 3 separate processing stages. There's parametric EQ, de-esser, and dynamics. And by the way, all these have presets. So, you know, you don't have to be a wizard, or not all your air staff have to be wizards to make this happen. You can preset different functions to make good things happen and let your air staff just use those. It also has effects macros. FX macros provides a means to store commonly used effects on a dedicated button, and then they can be applied to your mix with a simple mouse click or function keys. And once defined, you can use you can chain these together or in a sequence if you like. Vox Pro is the world's fastest phone audio editing software and controller. And I got to tell you, if you have ever used this, or if your talent has ever used Vox Pro, oh my goodness, they don't want to be without it. And let me show you once again this controller. This needs to be in your studio. If you take phone calls, get this, because your jocks will love it. And hey, my experience with this is the following. You know, I've been building this radio station in Hawaii, and we hired a morning guy, and he is amazing. I mean, what a talent. And he said, you got a Vox Pro? And I said, ooh, nope. He said, I got to have a Vox Pro. I said, well, tell you what, we're going to get you one. It may not be there on day one, but we're going to get you one. And so, yeah, we're going to put a Vox Pro into the new station that I've built in Hawaii on the island of Kauai. And our new morning guy, who has been in just about every major market. Yeah, he's one of those Johnny Fever types down the town. He says, I got to have a Vox Pro, and he's going to get a Vox Pro. George, you're going to get a Vox Pro. All right. Thanks a lot to the folks at Broadcasters General Store for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech and for Vox Pro, a mark of Wheatstone. You can get in touch with Broadcasters General Store really easily. They've been family owned and operated since 1979. Go to their website, and it's a little unusual. The website is BGS, as in Broadcasters General Store, BGS.cc. Really easy when you remember that. BGS.cc. Check them out. They got all kinds of gear, and Vox Pro is certainly one of them. Thanks a lot, BGS and Vox Pro, for sponsoring This Week in Radio Tech. All right, let's move it on. Chris Weigel, huh? Dumb and inexperienced. What are you talking about? Why is this a tease?
That's why I was on the show. You wanted to talk about inexperience and stupidity, and I got invited.
No, that's not why I invited you. That's still coming
okay.
up.
Oh, no, that's right. We're talking about the war stories, and we can choose from the concrete bucket or the OSHA infraction. Which one would you like to hear first?
Oh gosh, whichever. We're going to run out of time before do the better one. Whatever you think is more titillating, because we're going to run out of time before it's all over.
Well, we have had a situation where we were responsible. The radio network was responsible for distributing audio to a stage here and a stage here for a 4th of July celebration. So they wanted audio to be able to be routed around this huge area. So I was responsible for stringing up lots of cable and across a couple of streets. And I thought, how am I going to do this? We didn't have a wireless solution. So I said, hey, it's going to be a long, long, long run of Cat 5. And turns out it sounded okay, but I had to get the cable through two culvert pipes. And I thought, well, you know what? Through the pipes we go, and took the cable and just started crawling through. Big enough, crawled through the pipe, got to the next street and said, "Hey, let's crawl through that one." It was a little smaller, but I could fit, and pulled the cable through. It was 600-foot run of this stuff, and got the cables in place. And I was proud of myself for having done this. This was hard work. Again, another 98-degree day, and took a picture and put it on Facebook and said, "Hey, I've pulled lots of cable, but never through a culvert pipe under a street twice." And as it turns out, the safety coordinator for our area, sort of like the OSHA man, saw the picture on Facebook because he and I were buddies. He said, Chris, that's a confined space infraction. And he was the safety inspector for the organization for which I worked, which resulted in a 2-hour safety meeting the following week. And as it turns out, I was afraid of spiders and snakes, you know, crawling through these pipes. It turns out, and he sort of does make a point. He said, had you been in that pipe and a school bus stopped somewhere nearby, he said, exhaust, the first thing it does is go low. He said, and it could have made it through that pipe and you would have been passed out and no one would have known it because I had no help either. He said, the next time you do that, you need to have a mask and bring a meter. But here's the solution that we came up with for next time. Uh-huh. Tie the cable to a remote control car and pull it through the street with a car. My kids pull have these things everywhere, so that works great. Yeah. But I never thought about that. Yeah. What's that?
How long was the culvert, the longest one?
That's the problem. One was about 150 feet.
Oh, my goodness. Okay.
Way down in there, yeah. Yeah.
I was thinking the old bow and arrow trick, right, where you – yeah, you know, like ham radio guys do, or a slingshot trick.
Right? Yeah. No, I didn't think about that. That's part one of the stupidity thing was just, hey, crawl through the pipe. Why not? But so do beware. If you do need to pull a cable through a culvert, make sure you are prepared for that and talk to your safety coordinator because it can be a problem.
Yeah, either do it right, do it safely, or don't take any pictures of it. One or the other.
That's the other thing too. Don't put it on social media and tell everyone what you did, for crying out loud.
Yeah. All right. So that's one half of the story. What else is there?
This dates back to the first year of being an engineer. This would have been early 2000s. Hey, Chris, we need to be able to point that Marty Yagi at 450 megahertz back to the station from a ballpark. We're going to do a shot. and had nothing to put this thing on. There was no place to put this antenna. Of course, you know, one of those Scala Yagis only probably weighs about, I don't know, 6-8 pounds, if that. But I had to put the thing on something rigid, and it had to be there for a couple of days. So what I did was got a 12-foot piece of galvanized pipe, metal pipe, and a 5-gallon bucket, and stood everything up and got it nice and plumb, and mixed up some concrete, you know, a couple of quickrete bags, filled the bucket up, wait on it to set up. I said, I've got a great base now, nice and heavy for this antenna. It was a great idea until we decided we need to actually move this thing from where I had made it over to the ballpark. And we estimated that it probably weighed about 300 pounds. And it took two of us to move this thing. And someone was like, why did you not just, you know, why the 300-pound bucket of concrete, Chris? And to this day, I'm not sure why I did that, but it wasn't necessary. And it was impossible to move. And we used it for that one event and said, let's get rid of this thing. This is awful. It was cheap, but it was really heavy. Yeah. So don't do that. Don't do that. Anyway, so there's a couple stupid things that were early on that I won't do again. Won't do again.
Well, and I'm glad you're passing these along to others so that we can either learn directly from them or, you know, apply them to somewhat similar situations.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. That's the stupidity part of the show. Yeah.
We're coming up as we come to in the final stretch of the show. Chris Weigel is going to talk to us about sorry, not enough engineers available. But before we get into that story, I want to make sure, Chris Tobin, did you have anything else you wanted to share with us quickly on this 400th episode with a few war stories? You got anything that happened else you want to relate?
Well, I can say this early in my career as well. We've been known to do very crazy things. I had worked with folks that did crazy stuff as well. So we all did it together. So if there's going to be a disaster, it'd be at least more than one person. But one day we got a call from the office I was in, got a call from the program director. Say, hey, look, I need to do the tag sale, Sunday morning tag sale from the back of a boat. I'm like, okay, back of a boat. And I said, where? On Long Island Sound for the Mayor's Cup race. So it's the yacht race they do every year. I was like, yeah, okay, I'm familiar with it. Now I'm thinking we're staying in dock, right? And I figure I'll ask the question as we get closer to the day of the event. And I said, so we'll do the Marty unit. Yeah, the usual thing. Okay, great. And what after that? Well, we're thinking maybe we'll go out on the water a little bit. I was like, how little? You know, how far out? Oh, not far. Just, you know, a little bit from the dock. I was like, okay, fine, we can make that work. The nice thing was, I have to say, conveniently, our tower, 450-foot tower, was located right on the sound where we were going to be. So we could see it no matter where you went on Long Island Sound. It was great. Not that we needed that at the time, I thought. So we get on the boat, tag sail starts, things are going great. Then all of a sudden, somebody's talking to the pilot of the boat and says, oh, yeah, we can do that. Next minute, I know the boat is now suddenly bouncing off the water, and we're going at full throttle across the sound. I'm going, I thought the idea was to stay near. Oh, no, we're going to do this. It's great. Check it out and see what we can do. Two things occurred. One, I had to start securing the equipment very fast because it started sliding along the deck floor. That we saved. That was good. Did not go overboard. However, the tall tower that I was familiar with suddenly got smaller and smaller on the horizon. But we still had a signal. Then there was the best part. The host of the show turns out to be seasick. So it was an interesting ride, but we made it to Port Jefferson. All across we were in New York State from Connecticut over. We were doing a thing, and nobody at the studio had an idea that we left. They thought we were just spinning like circles in the harbor. And then somebody goes, "So how's it look out there?" and the host goes, "Well, I can see 3 Mile, what do you call it, Shoreham Nuclear Power Plant and Port Jefferson. It's pretty cool. This is a great place on Long Island." The host back in the studio is like, "What are you talking about?" Oh, we went across the sound. We're on Long Island. I'm sitting there like, you know, wondering, well, when does the signal drop out? When do we suddenly lose everything and the show goes totally, you know, off the rails? Didn't. What that did was spur the program director's imagination. And from there on in, we did remotes from every conceivable non-scary mechanism you could think of. We were broadcasting from a lot of places. That Marty unit we had three of them. And we had built a relay box and... Yeah, we did a lot of stuff. That was a crazy day.
It was amazing what they could do. You know, Wow. So it's This Week in Radio Tech, our 400th episode, and we're going to hear from Chris Weigel. The whole reason I got in touch with Chris was, first of all, I like him. I think he's a good engineer, and we hooked up at NAB. Was that? That was last year. It wasn't this year, was it? At 2017. Anyway, he wrote an article that popped up in one of the trades. Sorry, not enough engineers available. Chris, I can guess what it's about, but I think you've got a little bit of a story to tell and some advice to give. So why don't you take it away and tell us about not enough engineers available?
Well, each year at the NAB show in Vegas, they write for it was New Bay Media up until just a few weeks ago, and it became Future Media. But been writing for these guys for quite a while, and then work the show each year in Las Vegas, and they always say, hey, while on the floor, come up with a theme of something that you see happening that's going on that we can, you know, point out to folks who don't make it to the show each year. And this has sort of been stewing as an industry, you know, sort of an issue that's been coming up. And then I was sort of thinking about it before last April, before we went to the show, and then got there, and several things began to fall into place that really solidified what I was thinking about, this idea of not enough engineers available. And Chris and Kirk, you both know, because you spend so much time on the floor at the NAB show. Let me put it to you this way. If you're showing things like Vox Pro, or if you're showing things like webcams, if you're showing things that are IP driven in the studio, lots of toys to play with, people like that. Up until about the age of, how do I say this? Let me put it this way. If you go to an antenna manufacturer, the age of people who visit these booths suddenly goes way up, and you don't see the young folks there. Same thing with transmitters, especially transmitters and antenna systems. All the young people simply aren't there. And honestly, it includes me as well, because the way I've been involved in broadcast so far, I've had a lot of help with being able to be backed up as far as transmitters go. I haven't been personally responsible if the tube blows up or goes out or goes soft or anything like that. I've been into the operations and studio side of things for a long time, so I'm part of the problem as well. But the point is, the younger generation of broadcasters that's coming up are not so much interested in the RF propagation that obviously is the lifeblood of what we do. And the article that I put in, it came out on May 29th in Radio World. It didn't necessarily offer a solution other than to say, the people who are involved in the industry now that are experienced and maybe have some age, you are primed and ready to go to become a mentor. You know, come out from behind that desk and go out into the community and see these kids and say, hey, look, there's a job opportunity for you here. And one thing in the article I'll point out as an example was a guy that was in his church. Sort of got involved in doing the sound, and one of the sound guys was a broadcast engineer, and he said, hey, you know, we could use some help at the radio station I work at if you want to come over and see some nuts and bolts. And he mentored this kid, and this was back in the 60s. Now today, you know, he's getting some age on him, and he's saying, I need to start showing these young people how to do broadcast RF engineering. And it's a challenge because, again, we're so IP-driven these days. We see all of that, and it's fun to look at. And the young kids have come up playing video games and doing even some computer programming. Everything's IP, 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 online, 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 which we need. But today's older generation of broadcast engineer needs to say, hey, you kids, come on, let me show you something else that's important here. So that's the point of the article, is just to didn't necessarily say, here's how we fix the issue, but it encourages today's engineer to pass that information along to a younger audience or younger generation of engineer.
Gotcha. Yeah. Well, you're right about that. I hadn't really thought about where the younger guys hang out and where the older guys hang out. Mm-hmm. I know all the older guys, except for about two or three, hang out at our SBE meetings in Nashville. So Yeah, there's a lot of gray hair there, a lot of gray hair at all these SBE meetings, with a few exceptions. And I'm glad to see those.
It's funny because the SBE did put out a comment in this article, and they said that they are actively working on including and figuring out ways to get young people to be involved at the SBE chapter level, and that would be the prime spot for these seasoned engineers to say, let me show you what we do for a living and spark some interest.
In fact, while being on the board of directors, I'm keenly aware the SBE has a mentoring program that actually goes pretty well. Right. Our own Chris Tarr, who used to be a regular co-host on this show, he's acting as a mentor, and he has a mentee. But it's easy to find out about this program at sbe.org/mentor, M-E-N-T-O-R, right. sbe.org/mentor. I'll put that in the show notes so you can see about that. Well, Chris, you're right. Mentoring sure is a great way to bring somebody along and find out pretty quickly, mm-hmm. Hey, am I interested? Am I interested enough to pay attention for a while? I love RF. I love the whole science of propagation, at least to a point as it applies to broadcast.
Right.
Chris Tobin, you have any thoughts about mentoring and where we're going to get people to take over for RF engineering as long as we still need that?
Well, yeah, mentoring is definitely the way to start. And I can say my experience, the mentors that I had definitely helped me get to where I am today. That's without a doubt. Yeah, I think the hardest part, I know the folks here at the SBE chapter we have here in New York City, the hardest part has been, unfortunately, it's dollars, salaries. The interest in many cases is there. However, as we all know, if you're a transmitter guy or an RF guy in most facilities, the work is a little beyond what you normally are accustomed to. And if you're not passionate, that's going to hold you back. So it's a multi-tiered solution that needs to be come up with. But primarily, the mentoring is the best start. That's the only way it's going to get things rolling.
I have to believe that there could come a time when enough people retire who are good with RF and good with antennas, and there'll still be some consultants around. But who's going to do the work? There's got to be a time coming up when stations are off the air or suffering terribly from burnouts and blowouts and other, high, their transmitter's down to 12% power and has been for 3 months as they can't find anybody to work on it. At that point, what does a station pay for expert service to come in? Does it all of a sudden get real valuable toward the end of life of broadcast RF engineering?
Well, I can tell you from my personal experience, I've had working with a friend of mine's engineering firm, he has had in the last 3 years, one, two, three, we've had four calls from broadcast facilities that were in dire need because they had no staff person for the technical stuff. And their transmitter facility had reached the point where the filters were no longer filters of any kind. They were just mere obstructions of air. And the temperature in the racks had reached points where I think I could probably melt solder. There's a few other things that were going on. But they just weren't interested in spending the money. We told them, here's what's going to cost. Here's the hourly rate. Here's what you've got. I mean, we went up and did an inspection and gave them a rough estimate. Here's what it's going to take, and it's going to be rough. They didn't want to hear it. They're like, well, that doesn't make any sense. People, because it's a do-it-yourself world, keep looking at what they can do in their office or in their home with the technology, as Chris pointed out, with IP, and say, well, why can't you do the same thing at the transmitter site? It's like, dude, have you been there? Have you seen what a 50,000-watt transmitter does when it's not working right? You ever see an arc welder? Yep. Well, you got one, and it's going to start working on its way up your tower. I mean, I'm being serious. I have worked with a few broadcasters in the New York metropolitan areas. I'm not talking somewhere in the middle of nowhere that somebody can claim that's just poverty because of location. I'm talking some serious folks that just have their mindset's not in the right place. And they had the money. I looked them up. They're public companies, so I looked up the information. I said, well, you guys are definitely making money, so it's not that. It was just their view of what they think it should be or shouldn't be.
One thing that I did talk to an engineer in Las Vegas in April, and he said, what's interesting, he engineered six radio stations in one building, and across the street, you can't make this stuff up, across the street was a technical school. And I said, how many kids walk out of the door of that technical school and come next door to you and say, hey, I need a job? He said, zero. He said, and they leave a technical school and they don't know how to use a soldering iron. So the mentoring thing I think is huge, but we may also want to talk to the educators and say, we have a need here. How can we fix this?
And well, I've got to believe that at a technical school, and there's plenty of VOTEC schools across the country. Where I live in Tennessee, there are tech training schools that just specialize in various kinds of tech training. I'm sure zero of it is broadcast engineering or high power RF or almost any RF. But I got to believe that if mentors, if engineers like us can at least get a brief audience with some classes, I got to believe that a certain percentage of people, and it may be 1% or 3% or 5%, but a certain percentage of students are going to express some interest in this tech. They probably don't know that it exists now, but I got to believe that presented to them, some people will go, that sounds interesting. I'd like to find out more. And then you have an opportunity to actually mentor somebody and show them more about it. And if, and some of those we're going to, are going to continue. And some of them are going to say, nah, it's not for me after all. We've got to take one more break here. And, but I want you to stay tuned because as we finish up, Chris Weigel has what I hope, what I hope is some good advice about a career move. We were just talking about bringing people into the industry, but what if when it's time for you as an engineer to make a move? You've done all you can in this situation, and it just feels like, you know what? I'm looking for a new challenge, a better opportunity, maybe a bigger paycheck, and I'm better at what I did than I when I started, you know, here 10 years ago. What's the right way to get that done? And I like Chris's advice because Chris is a pretty upstanding guy. He's not going to burn any bridges behind him. So let's stay tuned for that advice from Chris Weigel coming right up after this from our friends at Lavo.
There has probably never been a better time in history to buy a new radio mixing console. Today's consoles are more sophisticated than ever, with more features and functions than you can shake a stick at. But have you noticed how complicated they are? There's a sea of knobs and switches and displays and buttons. Some of them look like you might need a pilot's license to do your show. Well, a board doesn't have to be complicated to be powerful. Just look at the new Ruby mixing surface from Lavo. The first thing you notice is how smooth and streamlined it is. Ruby has lots of cool tech, but what it doesn't have is that confusing ocean of buttons that clutter things up. Now, we all know that there are some console features the jock only uses once in a while, so why dedicate controls to them? Ruby fixes this problem by moving those once-in-a-blue-moon controls to a touch-sensitive, customizable GUI that happily shares screen space with your other studio software, helping you fight control room clutter. Thanks to this design innovation, talent that use Ruby produce smoother shows with less errors. Controls that are used the most fall naturally to hand, while functions that rarely need adjustment are easily controlled with just a couple of clicks in the context-sensitive GUI. And Ruby has cool features you won't find on other boards, like Auto Mix, an intelligent gain writing function that guarantees the perfect mix for multi-mic morning shows and call-in segments. Dual mode snapshots that instantly switch the motorized faders between on-air and production modes. And enough DSP and I/O options to make even your pro sound pals green with envy. And because quality is as important to Lavo as it is to you, every console is proudly built to fanatically precise standards at Lavo's own factory in Germany. If you're ready to declutter your control room, do yourself a favor. Check out the new Ruby and the other cool Lavo radio tech at www.lavo.com/twert.
And when you go to lavo.com, be sure you add the /twert on there. It'll take you right to the radio products page, and they'll know that you heard about it on This Week in Radio Tech. Thanks, Lavo, for sponsoring the show. All right, we're going to close out here. Chris Weigel, some thoughts on employment and how to make a move correctly.
First of all, it's not Lavo, not Lavo. When I first visited their booth at Vegas, I said Lavo, and they said, no, it's pronounced that with a V. Okay, got it. Great. Thank you. As far as career moves in this industry, I'm in the middle of one right now, actually, and it's sort of it's been a process. And I have learned that if you're leaving, and in this case, it's been on good terms, they're still not happy that you're leaving. So there are going to be some feelings, whether you want them or not. And everything, even though things are on the up and up, when you tell your employer you're leaving, it's not easy. But one thing I did found that was good, and I sought lots of advice on this, and everyone seemed to say, like you used this phrase earlier, take the high road, don't burn any bridges. And in this industry, I'm sure Chris Tobin probably has a lot more than me, but I'd been where I was for 16 years and had built the place how I wanted it, and had, I want to say, probably 60, 70, 80 pages of notes on how things worked, everything from IP addresses to login information to some routing your diagrams, that type of thing, what does what. And, you know, depending on the situation, when you go to leave a place, you may not want to leave your notes because you want to, you know, get one last jab on your way out the door. But one thing I really sought a lot of advice about was, hand over your notes and hand them over happily. even though it feels like it's your intellectual data, it's really not, because it applies to your employer. And so all of the documentation that I had on the place, it was in a huge Excel spreadsheet. And the people who were coming in to help take over some of my roles, I gave to them and said, here's how this stuff works. And then they sent two or three technicians in to say, we need some advice on how, you know, what have you got here? What have we, when you leave, what are we going to do with this? And invited them in happily. We had a good time and just kept everything on the up and up and was happy to ask questions. As a matter of fact, I don't work there now, but I still get texts and emails. Hey, what do we do here? How do we work on this? How do we do that? And I try to answer as good as possible. The point is, like you said at the beginning of the show, it's a small industry. And you've worked at a place for a while and they've taken good care of you. Just because you're leaving doesn't mean you need to, you know, push them off the cliff on your way out. And I've tried to make myself as available as possible and help with the transition in my absence. So my advice would be, whatever notes you have, keep them nice and neat in a book anyway. And on your way out the door, hand it to the next guy and say, here you go. This is how you do stuff around here.
Yep. Good advice. Good advice. I hadn't thought of that, but that is, wow. Chris, do you have any final thought on Chris, you've moved a couple of times here and there. I first met you at ABC Satellite. Got a final thought on moving employers?
Well, I'll agree with Chris about leaving the documentation behind. Don't think of it as a security NIP technique. I can assure you that it's not, because I've been burned by many of my predecessors who chose not to leave things behind. Which is fine. That's their choice. But I do not do that. And it actually has come back in many occasions to benefit me. I can say that after leaving ABC, I left everything there. I worked with a team of talented engineers. So everything was there and they needed what they had. And years later, I got a call from somebody. Hey, we're breaking down the place. We're moving facilities. You want to come by and grab stuff or see things? I'm like, yeah, sure. I can tell you that almost 15 years later, the documents that I put together and some of the notes on the racks were still there and still in use, which I thought was pretty cool. I was like, wow. And the guy looks at me and goes, yeah, we don't know who this guy was, but whoever the name is, I said, hey, hang on a second. Pull out my ID. I said, there you go. He's looking at me like, the guy's half my age. He was only there five. He's like, oh my God, you're the, I said, well, it was me and three other people. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, so there is a benefit to that. And trust me, your security for your job of any business, whether you're a photographer, a broadcast engineer, even a program director, is your skills. If you're talented enough, don't worry. You'll be fine. If you're not, then yeah, you should be concerned and maybe get a job where you don't have to worry about these things. But yeah, leave the documents behind. It pays off. And it does, because 2 years ago, a friend of mine called me up. He said, I just got a job at the station. The transmitter is in trouble. I don't know anything about RF, but can you come out and help me? I didn't tell him that I had done contract work there years earlier. We went out to the transmitter site. I said, why don't you go over to that cabinet and see what documents they have. We can figure out what's going on here. I waited. He comes back. I said, I got a book. And he starts looking through. He goes, wait a minute. Your name is in this book. I said, yeah, that's right. I was here 3 years ago. I documented and left it behind as a contract engineer. And it paid off because I got paid handsomely because I left documents behind. So, you know, yes, it's a personal choice. If you choose not to do it, so be it. But trust me, your skills are what pays, nothing else. Documents are just what they are, pieces of paper with ink on them.
Yeah, yeah. And I would add, as we close out, that even if you're leaving an employer that you don't like and you don't feel like you were treated well, take the high road anyway, because if you give that same bad attitude back that you feel like you got from that employer, it can't ever do you any good. It'll make you feel good for 5 minutes, but it can't ever do you any good. So leave graciously, move on graciously, and just do the right thing.
Well, there is karma. Yeah. There is karma. Yeah. Let me tell you your point. I left the place. I left it in good terms, but they were just nasty to me in every possible way. I said, fine. And friends of mine said, you shouldn't leave that way. You should give them, jab them one last time. I said, no. Someday I'll have an opportunity and I'll enjoy it then. And they wouldn't believe me. Well, years later, when you met me at ABC, it turns out they were an ABC affiliate. They had called affiliate services and complaining that their satellite was having problems and they can't operate this way. And this is ridiculous. And what are they going to do about it? So I got a call from affiliate services. They said, we got an affiliate with engineering issues. Can you call them back? I'm like, yeah, sure. Who is it? They told me the call letters. I'm like, really? Let me guess. Did you talk to so-and-so? They're like, yeah. How'd you know? That's a lucky guess. So I made that phone call, talked on the phone for a bit. They didn't remember who I was right away. And we got talking, and I'm talking to their engineer they hired, who's totally frazzled. And, you know, of course, they're on a speakerphone because that's how these guys operated. So I was like, oh, am I on speakerphone? He goes, yeah. Good. Is so-and-so there? Yeah. Oh, great. Tell him I said hi. And by the way, go to rack number 3. Go down about halfway your waistline, look inside that drawer, you'll find this, this, and this, and you should be able to correct the problem with the satellite receiver because somebody must have pulled out the card that was in there that was for the data. What?
Yeah.
There's an empty slot. Yeah. Then they got on the phone and said, is this you? I said, yes, it is. And by the way, you have 48 hours before we turn off your service because you're in breach of contract. I was just told to pass that along to you. What? Gotta go. Click.
Oh, gee. Karma.
Yeah. Took 5 years, but it was fun.
Guys, episode 400 has been a blast. I've enjoyed so much hearing your stories, Chris Tobin and Chris Weigel. Thank you so much for being a big part of episode number 400 of This Week in Radio Tech. I really appreciate it. And also thanks to Suncast, our producer, for producing the show. Thanks to all of our sponsors for making the show possible financially. They help us pay the bills, and I really appreciate that as well. Thanks to Andrew Zarian, the founder of the GFQ Network. We got to go. And we'll have a great show for you again next week and the next week and the next week, too. So stick around. Tell your friends about This Week in Radio Tech. Bye-bye, everybody.